Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest today is Phil Mosalek. Phil, thank you for joining me.
I'm very excited to be here. Excited to be on a random trek.
I'm excited to have you on. Tell the people a little bit about yourself, if they're unfamiliar with your work. Though if they are fans of The Incomparable, they probably know you.
Yeah, you know, I do a few podcasts on The Incomparable, which has been really very much an honor, I should say. You know, I do The Flash, I did Sons of Anarchy with Lisa Schmeiser and Tony Sindelar, who, you know, come to be my partners in crime in that regard. I've been to the Mothership a couple times, which has been nice, the Mother Zeppelin. Yes. I also have a side podcast as well that's not on The Incomparable called Preservation State, which is kind of in a hiatus moment right now, but actually gearing up to do some new episodes here shortly.
Oh, excellent. And I will say a little shout out for your Flashcast podcast. I enjoy that very much. I'm a big fan of The Flash, so if folks listening haven't listened to that podcast and are fans of The Flash or are interested in becoming fans of The Flash, why not give it a listen? I have not watched Sons of Anarchy, so I haven't listened to that podcast, so I can't speak to it whether it's good or not, but I'm sure it is with you and Lisa.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's Sons of Anarchy, and if you're into that, then there you are. But I'll tell you, you know, just some information is just leaked out on the internet with the season two of The Flash, which really looks to be in a whole new realm that we haven't seen before.
Oh, I have not seen this information, but I'm intrigued by its existence.
YouTube.
Oh, well, I'll check it out later. But we're not here to talk about Flash. We're not here to talk about Sons of Anarchy. We are here to talk about the show that is the franchise that is most beloved of me, which is why I host this podcast, Star Trek.
It makes sense.
I know. You know, sometimes it just happens the right way. Now, Phil, I think I may know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I always ask. Would you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
Would you consider me a Star Trek fan?
Well, I think when I asked you if you'd like to be on Random Trek, I may be misremembering this, but I think you said that you haven't really watched much Star Trek. So that would lead me to believe that you are not a Star Trek fan, but I could be wrong because I drink heavily. So I'm not sure.
Well, here's the thing. I would never consider myself, and I don't mean that in a negative light. I just wouldn't consider myself a Star Trek fan.
Okay.
I am more on the, you know, Luke Skywalker side of the fence when it comes to that kind of stuff.
So you pick your Star Wars over your Star Trek.
That's right. But now going back into my history a little bit, you know, I remember my parents watching it, and it came on somewhere around the Muppet Show time, and I can't remember exactly. It was on a different channel, and I know I kind of wanted to watch both. And I can tell you that there are a few movies in this world, in fact, three of them, that will make me cry. Mm-hmm. One, The Iron Giant. Easy.
Oh, that's a good movie.
Braveheart will make me cry.
I haven't seen Braveheart in a long time.
I don't watch it because of the cry factor.
Oh. Yeah, well, I can understand that.
Yeah, but the big one, the one that will get me almost, I mean, 10 out of 10 times is The Search for Spock, or I should say Star Trek 2, right? When Spock dies.
So Star Trek 3 is The Search for Spock, and I was going to be surprised because I figured you would be Wrath of Khan, but it was a curveball there. But
that's right.
A little misdirection.
When Spock, you know, says, you know, you have always been my friend. It just tears it out of me because the idea of self-sacrifice, you know, is you know, if you look at that right there, those three movies all have self-sacrifice. But for some reason, when Spock does it, it just, I mean, right now it's like kind of tearing the heart out of me a little bit. Just a little bit.
Yeah, I was, so Leonard Nimoy died last year or earlier this year. My time, time has become wibbly-wobbly for me. Doctor Who reference there for you.
I liked it.
So I did a special episode because obviously Leonard Nimoy is a big part of what makes Star Trek, Star Trek. And so as I was doing that, I was looking through clips and, I just rewatched that part of the movie. I didn't even watch the whole movie and I was crying because it is such a moving scene, and it is kind of the power of Star Trek is that we know these characters so well. And when we see this happening and Spock is sacrificing himself because he wants to save his friends, it just really hits you right in the heart.
And the fact that, you know, he is supposed to be this emotionalist being.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it carries it even that much further, and that Kirk, you know, had that connection with him. It's completely illogical, if you will, that those two should be such good friends.
Yes, they are complete opposites.
And the J.J. Abrams reboots, I can tell you that, like, not so much the first one, but the second one, mm-hmm. I can watch that anytime. It drives my family nuts. And I just like it. I mean, it there's something about it. But, you know, Star Trek episodes, no matter at what level. Now, again, it sounds like this has been a common occurrence, but I never saw any Enterprises at all.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I know. So that seems to be the running case. But when they're on, I don't actively seek them out, but if I happen to be scrubbing through channels, boom, I'll sit down and watch it. It just the idea of space. I've told my co-host Chris, I said, you know, I really feel like I was born the wrong time. I always wanted to, you know, have the luxuries of airlocks in space and to be able to fly through space, you know.
The luxury of airlocks. I've never thought of airlocks as luxurious.
Well, but they are they're more utilitarian, but you know, the idea of these airlocks that would, you know, come and join us.
Oh yeah, I could see that. It's a sense of adventure, right?
That's right.
It's a portal to the unknown. So it sounds like you have more Star Trek fandom in you than I thought. But you would say your Star Wars would be kind of your quote-unquote home fandom, because I've had many people on who like Star Wars more than they like Star Trek. Many people who like, you know, Doctor Who or Buffy. We accept all fandoms here on Random Trek, because I'm open-minded.
Right. I mean, that's the beautiful part about the show. That's why I like it.
Well, thank you. So you like Star Trek fine enough, probably more than the average bear. So that leads me to my second question, which is, if you had to pick a series that you like the most, what would you pick? Can you pick it, given kind of you're a dabbler, it sounds like?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because the episode that we picked, I realized that there were a couple reasons why I actually kind of did like Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably more geared towards, I remember watching that very first, The Next Generation, and I believe it had the kind of living entities, but they thought they were some sort of ships. But I can't remember. But I remember being there like the first night it was on,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, "Wow, this is really interesting. I mean, this really looks cool." So I did watch quite a lot of Next Generation, but I love the intro and the theme music to Voyager, and I know that sounds crazy. But I really do. I mean, I love, you know, when that ship actually has kind of a, you know, it can kind of transform a little bit and shoot off. And that scene where it's going through this, like, you know, space gas, and it's kind of getting kind of cut by the shields. Just, it's fascinating.
I am with you there. I think that Voyager is not my favorite Star Trek series. It's not my least favorite Star Trek series. Thanks, Enterprise. But the opener for Voyager is probably my favorite opening of any Star Trek series, for the very same reasons that you, and I like the theme as well. It doesn't have, obviously, the original series and Next Generation have that great voiceover, so that's kind of a classic Trek thing, but just seeing the Voyager going through and traveling around and going, I really like that scene where it's over the rings of that planet and you can see the reflection.
Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking about that.
It's beautiful. So kudos to whoever did that, because it's fantastic. I won't go as far as to say it's the best part of Voyager, because I don't think that's true, but I think it is a fantastic part of Voyager.
I did like the idea of them getting Genesis, jettisoned.
Yes.
Out into the Delta Quadrant,
mm-hmm.
and to being really where no one had ever been before. You know, it was kind of like if you could have taken the original Star Trek and said, okay, well, now you have nobody, and I don't know that they could have handled that quite as well as this crew.
No, I don't think that they could have, and I think it's a great... I've always said this about Voyager, it's a great concept. I feel like they didn't... Well, so it was a product of its time, right? What I always wanted Voyager to be, and what it wasn't, was Battlestar Galactica, right? That's a gritty... It shows you kind of similar ideas, right? It shows Battlestar Galactica, things are breaking, it's really tough, they're having a hard time. And in Voyager, similar situation, but everything's going all right. They encounter a lot of wacky stuff, but the ship is always kind of their steady companion. Nothing's really falling apart. There is a great episode, Year in Hell, where stuff just goes really bad. And that's kind of what I wanted the whole series to be. Although, when you think about it, Star Trek is about hope and, you know, finding a way through it. And so I'm not sure that would be the appropriate thing for Star Trek, but I always felt like it was a missed opportunity.
Well, and in this episode, especially in, you know, and funny you should say about breakdowns, I mean, the actual ship is broken into separate temporal pieces.
That's true. 37 of them. So I guess I should say, and everyone who's listening already knows what episode we're going to talk about, but I will say it anyway, for the benefit of someone who perhaps just downloaded this and hasn't looked at their podcast client. It is Voyager's Shattered, which is Season 7, Episode 10. And this is the episode in which... The space-time continuum on Voyager, highly localized, is shattered into 37 different fragments, which is an interesting idea.
I wasn't expecting kind of how Chakotay deals with it, because he seems to be our character who can transcend all these fixed points, because he was somehow he was hit by this, it looked like basically a lightning bolt, but it kind of made him look half old, half young.
Yeah,
it was really bizarro.
I guess it's a bolt of temporal energy or something, and it had the effect, which is also another interesting idea, of shifting his body into these different time periods, right? So he had I think the doctor said you had like the kidneys of a 12-year-old, but the face of an 85-year-old or something like that.
The liver.
There you go. And of course, the doctor, who's one of my favorite characters on Voyager, is able to come up with some concoction. He saves the, Chakotay with a string of technobabble, which actually made me laugh out loud. I don't even remember what it said, but
well,
it was.
let me stop you right there, because this is something that I don't feel like I was as familiar with as I should have been. But it seems as though they really jargoned the hell out of this episode. I mean, there's a lot of hyperbolic technobabble, especially on the right on the offset. The little girl was working on a puzzle, and is that guy a Borg that was with her?
Yes. So he is there's an episode that I think maybe I talked with Glenn Fleshman about, where they save some Borg babies and bring them on board and deborgify them, a la Seven of Nine, and then it's left up to Seven of Nine to kind of raise them.
Ah, okay. The Borg kids.
Yep. He's a Borg kid.
So am I to believe that possibly that is this the last season of Voyager?
That is correct.
Okay. So we were looking at, this episode kind of gave us a wide berth of like things that have happened from 7 years to 5 years, in time.
Yeah. It's almost a clip show, but it's an interesting spin on a clip show in that it's not a clip show, but they have broken the ship up into these 37 temporal zones that go back to actual other episodes of Voyager. And so, you know, Chakotay, who's our main character and second in command of Voyager, is, because of a string of technobabble that the doctor talks about, has been inoculated against these temporal rifts, and he can go back and forth between them all. And so he goes back and forth, and then he's like, oh, this was 5 years ago. Oh, this is before we were even in the Delta Quadrant. Oh, this is the one where my ex-girlfriend, who was an undercover Cardassian, decides to take over the ship. And so he can kind of, you know, chart where we are in Voyager's history, except when he gets into the future, because obviously he hasn't seen the future yet. But
yeah, that would have been kind of a cool thing. I don't think they ever touched on the future at all, did they?
They did. So when they go to Astrometrics, they meet the Borg baby all grown up along with Naomi Wildman, and they are, you know, 17 years in the future.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
And that was the circle around from Chakotay getting his booze with the kids, and then
exactly.
Okay. Ah.
See,
look, I missed it.
That's all right. You know, this you have to pay attention to watch Voyager. I tell you.
Well, there was a little bit of something going on at the house at that time. I think it was dinner time, so there was some scrambling around. That may have
looked.
Yeah. Well. Okay.
And of course, the temporal prime directive. If you were to, so they go into this section of the ship that's 17 years in the future, and the Borg baby, who's now a Borg man, and Naomi Wildman are like, oh, it's Captain Janeway and Chakotay, and Chakotay's like, why are you surprised to see me? And they say, well, you died 17 years ago, and so that I wasn't sure if Chakotay in their timeline had died in this episode. So when he gets hit by the temporal bolt, he died in that timeline.
It's gotta be that.
I guess so.
Yeah.
And so
that wasn't explained quite well.
Tell me everything. But you
can't.
That's
right. But now, you know, now Scott, is there such a thing as the what do they call it now? The temporal
the temporal prime directive.
That's right.
And
I'm fully aware of prime directive.
Mm-hmm. There is a temporal prime directive, and it is actually played to some comedy in Deep Space Nine when they go back in time. In an episode where they go back to the original series, it's called Trials and Tribulations. They go back to the Trouble with Tribbles episode. And there's a whole section of Starfleet that is assigned to make sure that the timeline is the way it should be. And they visit Captain Sisko and they're like, you didn't break the temporal prime directive, did you? And he said, well, I wanted to meet Captain Kirk. And they're like, oh, Captain Kirk. And he is the reason there is a temporal prime directive, because Captain Kirk would just go back and forth in time and fiddle around with anything. So it exists. It's canon.
It's interesting because, that, you know, I remember even, you know, the classic series. This show has never been scared of using and going through timelines. And it's that, you know, because, you know, you play with time, you can get into a lot of trouble. And even within the J.J. Abrams, you know, reboot, I mean, Spock breaks the rules all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, which is fascinating.
Spock is, you know, he figures, well, my planet's dead. I'm in an alternate timeline already, so I can fiddle around. And the knowledge he has is actually not correct anymore, right? Because the timeline has diverged. So I imagine Spock, in his logical gymnastics, figures, well, I'm not breaking the rules because it's actually a different timeline. So what I know hasn't happened yet and may not happen. So it's okay. Much like,
you know,
in Star Trek IV, when Scotty, they need transparent aluminum, and Scotty's like, well, alter the timeline if we tell someone how to make transparent aluminum. And Dr. McCoy says, how do we know this guy didn't invent it?
Again, they're not fearful of it at all. And it seems like, man, this is something you guys really kind of are just kind of knocking around pretty haphazardly.
Yeah, that's why they have the temporal prime directive, so you don't do these things.
Well, they still like to go through time all the time.
Well, so in this episode, they came across an anomaly that shot them and broke them into different fragments. So they weren't trying to do it. It just happened. And then Chakotay wants to fix it.
And I'll tell you, I really kind of dig Chakotay's look with the tattoo and all. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really a big departure. And even the idea of Seven of Nine, which was always a curious character to me anyway. And of course, growing up, I mean, well, I'm not going to lie. I mean, fairly sexy. And
fairly sexy.
Yeah.
She is sexy. We can all agree. She is a very good looking woman. Her uniform leaves very little to the imagination, unless
not
she's
at all.
Borgified.
And even as a Borg, I mean, that was like, I mean, we're talking about transparent aluminum. I mean, that was a skin tight uniform.
That is true. But I don't feel bad about saying that. A, because it is the truth. She is an attractive woman, and I think she would say that herself. But Seven of Nine is a fully fleshed out character as well. So it's not like they just put her on because she's sexy. Although I'm sure that is part of the reason. But she plays an integral role in the series as time goes on, and the interplay, not so much in this episode, but the interplay between Janeway and Seven of Nine is fantastic. And that's what makes it so much fun when, they meet the future people, and they're like, gee, I wish Seven of Nine were here. And Janeway's like, Seven of what now? Because that's right. Past Janeway, and she hasn't met Seven of Nine yet. And she's kind of freaked out that they're a Borg and things are happening. She doesn't like anything that's happening.
I was always fascinated by the Borg in general, especially on Next Generation, when I believe that was the first time they were introduced.
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay. And just the idea of this mechanic. I mean, I always like the idea of like, oh man, if I could kind of, you know, outfit myself with some techno stuff. I mean, but they became the perversion of that, which kind of made me like, yeah, I'm not sure if that's really what I'm all about. But, you know, when Picard became a Borg and then the Borg Queen, I thought that was actually pretty awesome.
Well, I think I'm going to say for me, my favorite Next Generation movie is without a doubt, by far, First Contact. It may, in fact, my favorite Star Trek movie of all time, of course, is Wrath of Khan, because seriously, it's Wrath of Khan. First Contact, maybe second. It's a tie between, I think, First Contact and Voyage Home, just because Voyage Home is so much fun. But I say all of that because the Borg are such great villains. And they play a huge part in Voyager. And if some people, myself included, think that perhaps they went back to the Borg well a little too often in Voyager. But I can understand the temptation just because they're such great villains.
Were the Borg, like, are they heavily, like, populating in the Delta Quadrant?
Yes.
And okay. Because I was just like, man, they seem to be hitting these Borg pretty hard and fast. Like, I remember watching, you had gotten me kind of interested in watching Voyager far before this episode. And you didn't know that, but you did.
Oh.
And so I was watching, trying to find the one where Seven of Nine, that whole series where she comes on board and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I believe when I was listening to you talk to Lisa, a couple episodes ago, that was when they had introduced that species 42975, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's during that particular part. Am I correct?
I'm not sure if that's the same episode arc or not. I believe Seven of Nine comes in a two-parter. I think it's a season-ending two-parter. Because the big reveal is, oh, she wants to be human again. And Janeway's like, okay, we can't trust her, but we have to trust her because she wants to be human. And I think then species whatever comes in later, but I could be wrong.
Okay. I didn't do my due diligence and really figure out exactly what episode she came in at. So I just kind of started in that season. And that's when they were this new species, whatever. I was just like, boy, that's kind of oddball that they did it with the CG effect and everything. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't expecting that from Star Trek.
Well, I think that was a big kind of exciting thing at that time, because just like you said, it's a big CGI thing. I'll ask you, since you watched it recently, does it hold up?
It doesn't not hold up, because there's that was a double negative, so it does hold up. I think it holds up for what it is, and I accept it for that. I'm not looking at it. It holds up better than prequels. How about that?
Well, that's fair enough. And plus, well, that's because, so we're going all over the place here, but so you're a Star Wars fan.
Well, you said random.
No, it's true. I'm all for it. But the prequels are interesting cultural artifacts, I think we can say. But they are also perhaps a direct result of the kind of the opposite of, you know, limitations breed creativity, right? Because George Lucas, of course, a creative genius. I think we can all agree on that. He invented Star Wars. Fantastic imagination. But then you remove all constraints. You give an infinite budget, because basically that's what George Lucas has, all the money in the world. He has the finest digital artists and special effects people in the world at his beck and call. He can make anything happen. And what happens when you can make anything happen? The prequels. And they're just so just dripping with digital effects that as soon as, you know, it's 2 or 3 years later, it just looks like it's dripping with digital effects, whereas with Species 842-8472, I looked it up on Memory Alpha.
Nice.
They're just a little like a dot of special effects in kind of practical effects, right? So it doesn't look as bad, I think, through the test of time.
I can accept it because it very similar to some of the other Farscape, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It had that same feel, you know. And so it was like, well, okay, this is fine. I can deal with it.
It's all right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it gets the point across. You know, is it a guy that's painted half black, half white? No, but that's okay. If you have the budget for it, go for it, I guess. But I think where Star Trek differs greatly from Star Wars, and this is probably why I enjoy Star Trek in this regard, is there's a lot more intercommunication and interplay. Like, if I were to ask you, you know, it seems as though from an outside point of view that Star Trek seems to have very somewhat tightly knit stereotypes or character types, archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Seven of Nine obviously is the Spock of Voyager.
Yes.
Or am I absolutely off on that?
No. I think that so the original series kind of set in motion the you know, quote unquote, Holy Trinity archetype that is Kirk, McCoy, and Spock. And every subsequent Star Trek series has had a Kirk, McCoy, and Spock. Next Generation, Kirk was Riker. Captain Picard is kind of his own thing. Spock is obviously...
He really did kind of break a mold.
He did. Data is Spock, obviously. Dr. McCoy, I think, is Dr. Crusher. Or maybe
Yikes,
Dr. Pulaski.
That just doesn't even seem right.
Depending on... more Pulaski than Crusher. Voyager, we'll just skip to Voyager because that's what we're talking about, right? So I think... I think Captain Janeway has a little bit of Kirk in her. She is much more level-headed than I think Captain Kirk is, but she certainly has bravado and kind of a willingness to take charge, whereas Captain Picard has that same thing, right? But he is, I feel like he kind of lets a consensus build, and then he kind of takes over people. Not that people don't respect Captain Janeway, because they do, but I feel like they think of Captain Picard as like their father, and they really want to impress him. Whereas with Janeway, they want to work with her, if that makes any sense.
Well, and I noticed there's a huge difference in her from, you know, from the very beginning. She's almost extremely stoic and, you know, sans any femininity.
Mm-hmm.
And As the series goes on, I mean, she definitely has some changes, which is, you know, great. That's a growth in character. That's awesome. And, you know, we think about women in science fiction. I mean, really, she's kind of pivotal, I think, in if you, you know, step back and just science fiction wise, you know, you have Ellen Ripley and you know, I'm going to say her. But, you know, you don't have very many women in leadership positions in that universe.
It's true, and it's a shame, and I think that that's why I think a lot of people didn't like Voyager, frankly, because there was a woman captain, and by a lot of people, I mean dudes. At first blush, I will include myself. I was kind of like, well, I don't know if I'm ready for a woman captain when Voyager premiered, but as I've been watching more and more Voyager, and I've said this on countless episodes of Random Trek, the problem with Voyager is not Captain Janeway. Captain Janeway is one of the best things about Voyager. I would think, possibly, I'd say she is the best thing about Voyager. She's a great character. Kate Mulgrew is a great actress. And you can see that in this episode because we start with Captain Janeway as, you know, present Captain Janeway. She knows Chakotay. She knows the lay of the land, right? She's been through a lot. She's matured as a commander because of all of the things, the tough decisions she's had to make. And you juxtapose that with Captain Janeway before they get lost in the Delta Quadrant. And it's her first command, and she's a little nervous, as she should be, and maybe kind of second-guessing herself about some stuff. And you can see that total shift in the two captains as you watch this episode. And I think it's fascinating.
I think she is extremely undervalued and underrated for sure. Because I think I've really enjoyed watching Voyager. Again, you know, when you have a great beginning to a show, I'll sit with it until you do something that's really junky. You bring me into that world. I'll stick with you the whole way.
Uh-huh. Mm. Well, yeah, and I agree. And I think that Voyager. Well, Voyager has some problems. There are some characters I don't like at all. Neelix being one of them. Kes, I never liked, although they got rid of her fairly quickly. Tom Paris, I don't like at all. Harry Kim, I don't like.
I never understood, like, you know, I remember watching one, I think it was when Paris was first getting involved, and it may have been the beginning pilot. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, it was kind of, you know, they were kind of trying to do some universe building with what exactly he's done to, you know, really piss off the Federation. Mm-hmm. And it was like this guy you're telling me, like, all he seems to be is like kind of like, I mean, kind of a huckster, but he doesn't look like that. He looks like one of the nerds that's watching this thing. You know what I mean? He doesn't look as nefarious as you seem to be making him out to be.
That's true. I think I've had someone on here describe him as a frat boy in space, and he kind of has that kind of whiff of a frat guy. Not that I have anything against frat guys. A stereotypical frat guy, I should say.
There you go. There you go.
But his character has a little interesting nuance, right? Because his father is an admiral, and so he kind of got into trouble and joined the Maquis, and his father was unhappy about all this stuff.
Now, what is the Maquis? I don't think I ever really figured that part out.
Well, that is a good question. So the Maquis are kind of, I wouldn't go as far as to say that they are rebels. Maybe they're a little bit of rebels, but they are not happy Federation citizens. They don't fall in line with the Federation where, you know, it's kumbaya. You feel like everybody in the Federation gets along. Everyone kind of agrees on everything. There's a consensus. It's a happy, peaceful land.
Yeah, we're not used to that.
We are not used to that. The Maquis are kind of like, this is crap. We need to, you know, colonize some worlds. And I think it all started because the Cardassians wanted some worlds, and the people who are living on it were not happy with this, but the Federation was like, well, we signed a treaty with the Cardassians, we gave them these worlds, you gotta move. And they're like, screw you, Federation, we're gonna start our own little guerrilla warfare kind of thing. And that's the Maquis.
Yeah, the Federation is slightly too unified. I think that's probably one thing that's always kind of bothered me is their politics. And I understand everybody working for the same goal, mm-hmm. but not everybody is, you know, not everybody is the same. So you're gonna have differences of opinion.
Well, but in the future, everybody gets along and everyone is reasonable.
We know that doesn't work like that. We'd love that to happen, but we need a defining, galvanizing moment. And that's curious to me. When was that galvanizing moment in the Star Trek universe? Like when I was like, whoa, we got to do this. Now, was that when they first developed warp?
Well, I think that I would say that in canon, that moment is when they develop warp and they have first contact with the Vulcans, and humanity realizes that we are, in fact, not alone in the universe, and that we should straighten up our act. Enterprise kind of explores this a little bit, because the Vulcans are, the humans and Vulcans have a relationship, but the Vulcans are kind of like, you know, kindly overlords, and they kind of just let us know little bits and pieces of information, because they don't want to give us everything. But we are then a post-warp society, so we're part of the grand culture that is amongst the stars. And so people say we should get together, be nice, and work things out.
I mean, it's something Gene Roddenberry dream that hopefully at some point we will all, you know, take into consideration and not be so selfish.
That's true. And it helps that they have unlimited energy and can turn energy into matter. So nobody has to work. Nobody has to worry about anything. There's no hunger, in the Federation at least. So that frees up some societal pressures from a bunch of people. Although it creates a bunch of other ones that Star Trek never really deals with. So, cause you know, that's like billions and billions of people with nothing to do. Like, why does anybody join Starfleet? You don't need a job.
Right. I mean, you could literally, it would be perfect for people who just want to, you know, sit around their couch and, you know, play video games.
That's what I want to do.
You can only get paid for it.
But you don't need to get paid because there's no money.
Yeah.
So you could just do whatever you want.
So utopistic.
Unless you are stranded in the Delta Quadrant on a ship that is shattered into 37 temporal zones. And then you gotta work with Captain Janeway and figure out how to get everybody back together. And the way they get everybody back together is also kind of a string of mumbo jumbo, because they basically decide, okay, so Voyager has this organic component in it that is unlike any other ship in Starfleet.
Yikes.
Yes. And it's these gel packs that have like some kind of like, I don't know what they have in them.
It's like a nervous system. It's got like basically, you know, when you get a spinal tap, you know, it's got that kind of liquid in your spine.
Yeah. Just a bunch of Ziploc baggies with that stuff in it, seemingly. And so they say, okay, let's inject this anti-time stuff into these Ziploc baggies full of blue Kool-Aid throughout the ship. And then we will trigger some kind of other technobabbly thing, and it will unite all of the fragments into the regular time stream that it should be in, and everyone will be fine. And of course,
yeah, I think that was the one thing that kind of, you know, kind of irks me a little bit. It's like, so time is now a pliable substance that can be, you know, just given to a ship or a person. Mm-hmm. I can inject it with myself and, you know, make sure I'm temporally balanced. I mean, I would love to have, I mean, if I could invent that, we'd all want to be temporally balanced.
It's true.
Aligned. That's right. Temporal alignment.
Yes. And so I did have, so they never talk about this ever again, obviously. But it seems like a huge breakthrough that would have huge ramifications for many different aspects. Of course, they're stranded in the Delta Quadrant, so they can't do anything. But you'd think they might want to fiddle with it. Maybe we could somehow speed up time or something so that
When you have spare subroutines over years, you can do that. And so really a hologram invented it.
He's been running for 3 years, so he has a lot of time on his hands. And so I bring all this up because, A, it's the central plot of the episode, but B, it gives us a chance to hop through a bunch of episodes, and it brings us to an amusing, well, depending on your viewpoints of, and speaking of George Lucas also, he was heavily influenced by these 50s B-movie serials, and there is an homage, if you will, to it in that Tom Paris, also a big fan of these serials, and he has a bunch of holodeck programs where I think they're Chaotica is the villain.
That's right.
It's in black and white, and there's Satan's Robot, I believe, is the name of the robot.
It was the monochrome universe.
Yes, I love that. And although it made me think, I think Captain Janeway would know what black and white is. Maybe not in the future. Maybe nobody watches black and white movies, but she does say, how have we entered a monochrome universe?
That's right. I really enjoyed that, actually, because it was, you know, they had kind of the same guy who was in from Plan 9, the kind of lookalike, and the Ming the Merciless, Flash Gordon. And what the robot, that looked almost identical to one I've seen, and I couldn't tell you what movie it is.
Well, I think that's the whole point. It's a pastiche of all these different kinds of things, which makes it amusing, and even more amusing because Captain Janeway, having never experienced it, is totally not amused by it.
Right, but she needs to play along and not talk about the eighth dimension.
That's right. She is the Arachnia, the bride
Arachnia,
of Chaotica. And so she must seduce him into letting them inject the gel packs because they can't make the... As soon as it happened, I thought to myself, why don't they just tell the holodeck to stop this program?
Well, they tried that.
And then they tried that. As I said that out loud. And then Chakotay said, holodeck, end program. And the computer says, unable to comply. No.
Well, he was not. He was the temporal balancing act is very hard on computers.
It's true, and that's an awful error message. It doesn't tell you why it can't comply. It just says unable to comply.
Oh, that's rough. It's no HAL 9000. I can tell you that.
Yeah, it's true.
But you would think that those characters would have a complete fit after being in monochrome world and then pulling off a few boulders and seeing blue and red and colors. You would think that they would just think it was the, you know, the devil's work.
That's true. And I understand why they did that from a visual perspective, right? Because it does look cool. But you think Chakotay and Janeway were both black and white. So is that, I don't know, it's making my head hurt to think about how the holodeck works. And if you go into the holodeck, then does it automatically somehow project a black and white hologram around you so that you are monochrome when you're in this environment, but yet it can't do it on the gel packs for some reason?
Well, that's inside the system. It, you know, it's just on the outskirts of those holographic walls.
Oh, maybe you need, the emitters are so aligned that they can't cover that, because obviously why would you ever want to do that? You would never see them.
Right, right. I mean, that's, you know, those are the boulders there. Though it was very, it was very telling. I felt like I was in kind of a B-rated game. Ooh, there's something shiny in the corner. Go check it out.
Mm-hmm. That is true. And I have so many questions. So they move the boulders and then the gel packs are there. So does that mean that the boulders were actually an access panel that was made by the holodeck to look like boulders? And if so, what if you just kick that boulder by accident? Would an access panel come out and hit you? I don't understand. I have so many questions, Phil. Can you answer any of these questions?
Well, you know, I think this is one of those situations, and I feel like I've seen ideas of this before when I see the holodeck, because I always have that question is like, you know, how far can you actually walk in the holodeck? Or is it just a moving platform? Is
force fields. It makes you think
you're
moving,
floating?
But you're stationary. But it makes you think that you're moving. You're like on a treadmill, only it's a force field.
Okay. So right there, even to that extreme, now they shouldn't have even been able to put their hands over there, because technically they would never be that close to the wall. I mean, they would have to almost kind of go inside the matrix.
It's true.
To get that close to a wall, and they can't, obviously it's being projected, so they're not going to be able to see it.
Well, Phil, what did you think of this episode overall?
You know, for not seeing a lot of Voyager and seeing little bits and pieces here and there, this is actually a pretty cool episode to jump into, because you get an idea of, well, what were they like early on, mm-hmm. and what kinds of things they go through. In fact, I would almost say, I mean, it's kind of sad that it came near the end of the season, but it gives a good run through where you can say, ooh, I kind of want to watch this series. And quite honestly, I may do that to my son's chagrin.
Your son did not enjoy it?
Well, you know, he does a lot of laughing.
You know, I understand.
As soon as the techno babble kind of starts out, he's like, oh boy. And when it went black and white, he was just like, this is so stupid.
Well, I can understand that. Well, right. What isn't stupid is that I had you on the podcast, because this was wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Fantastic time.
Next on Random Trek, Voyager Season 4, Episode 20, Vis-a-Vis.